Good evening. In this episode of News Wrap, in amongst the updates, we've got two focused topics for you. A shock divorce between longtime political allies, Democratic Alliance and the Freedom Front, and an in-depth look at the offshore discoveries that are transforming Namibia from a sleepy backwater into the hottest oil and gas province on Earth. First up, though, let's recap what's happening in business. In your business news headlines, it's been a tough quarterly earnings season for US big tech, with disappointing results and AI investments failing to convince Wall Street, erasing $6.5 trillion from global markets. However, the gig economy has been shining brightly. Uber, DoorDash, Instacart, and JustEatTakeaway.com have exceeded expectations with double-digit revenue growth reported by them across the board. This resilience highlights strong demand for rides and deliveries, even as other sectors face economic uncertainties in the world's biggest economy. Other tech companies that bucked the downward trend were BizNews portfolio constituents Palantir and Cloudflare. Their share prices rose in the double digits after their results beat analyst forecasts. Here at home, Impala Platinum announced it will report impairments of nearly 20 billion rand, or over $1 billion, and a full year loss of up to 17.8 billion rand, primarily due to declines in platinum group metals. Over 80% of the write-down is linked to its Rustenburg complex. Glencore has decided against spinning off its coal business after consulting shareholders. It announced this when declaring interim results that reported a 33% drop in earnings and a 9% fall in revenue. In a mirror of what ArcelorMittal here in South Africa has been facing, Chile's biggest steel plant has halted production entirely due to Chinese dumping. It caused $500 million of losses, and it's risking 20,000 jobs. Naspers and Prosus Chief Financial Officer Basil Skordos will retire on the end of November after 29 years with the group. The chairman, Koos Becker, thanked him for his exemplary service and leadership, which significantly contributed to the company's global e-commerce success. Outer has urged Parliament's Transport Committee to address governance issues at the South African Maritime Safety Authority. Despite a new board, concerns remain over the lack of a permanent chief executive since 2016 and the reinstatement of the COO, Sobhantu Tilahi, who faces serious allegations and legal disputes. And on the global front, in the UK's ongoing violence after the murder of three little girls in Stockport, anti-racism demonstrators outnumbered the far-right protesters in Britain, preventing planned violence over the past few days against asylum seekers and immigration lawyers. Russia has declared a state of emergency in Kursk after 1,000 Ukrainian troops and several tanks crossed the border. The Kremlin says further advances were prevented. And finally, Italy is to double its flat tax that has been encouraging wealthy foreigners to emigrate there. It's going up from 100,000 euros to 200,000 euros amid controversy over rising property prices. Now on to the unravelling in Oudtshoorn. We all knew what to expect, or rather to expect the unexpected, after the results of South Africa's election on the 29th of May. Well, it happened last week when Herman Mashaba of Action SA announced his party's decision to support the ANC in Johannesburg, prioritizing the city's needs over previous campaign promises like, "Over my dead body would I work with the ANC." But the past week's developments in Ostrich Central caught most of us by surprise. The Democratic Alliance and the Freedom Front Plus have been fast friends for decades, but they're now on the brink of divorce. The Freedom Front Plus withdrew its support from the DA in Oudtshoorn, switching into a new coalition with the ANC, which resulted in the Freedom Front Plus's local leader becoming the mayor. Well, the rift appears to be spreading to multiple other municipalities in the Western Cape, the second domino falling yesterday when the DA ended its coalition with the Freedom Front in Laingsburg. I spoke to both sides to understand what's behind this and what it means nationally. Let's start with Cape leader of the Freedom Front, Corne Mulder, who gives us a breakdown of that 25-seat council in Oudtshoorn.
So we did succeed in June of 2022 to put a coalition together consisting of four parties, the Democratic Alliance with their seven, us with three, Ikosa with two, and then a local party called Saamstaan with one, which gave us 13. And we did form a coalition that governed since June of 2022, and we were going along happily. But along the way, it started to become clear that we've got a problem. And the problem was basically that the mayor of Oudtshoorn, a person with the name of Chris McPherson, became a problem because it seems that he does not understand how coalitions work. So we made it clear to the Democratic Alliance that we've got some problems, that we are not keeping to the provisions of the coalition agreement. If there's disagreement, the mechanisms of the coalition agreement should come into play where matters that are not dissolved are referred to other bodies. That did not happen. And it became clear that the mayor himself was just going on all by himself. Let me give you an example. The budget is quite an important issue in a local government, and that needs to be approved. So the budget was discussed in the coalition's joint caucus of those four parties. And three of the parties made certain proposals to try and alleviate the high municipal rates, etc., and how we could do some savings. The mayor was not happy with that. In the end, his response was, listen, this is my budget, and you represent small parties. And then he went across and he made a deal with the ANC behind the back of the other coalition parties to get his budget through. Now, that is no coalition. That you can't operate. The moment he did that, that was the end of the coalition, basically.
That's interesting. The DA has got a reputation, and deservedly so, for being able to manage well. So as a consequence, perhaps that's in the DNA now. You know, we the guys who can manage well, nobody else. You've got a challenge. The new mayor of Oudtshoorn is your guy.
Yes, absolutely. The parties in the government of local unity then decided we don't want to see that the ANC suddenly now takes charge of Oudtshoorn, because immediately the DA jumped on this immediately and they immediately framed us, or they tried to frame us, you are now in bed with the ANC. It's absolutely laughable. That's while they are sitting with 12 members in the executive on national level serving with the ANC. But that is the kind of cheap politics being played to try and frame you in that instance. So the government of local unity then had a council meeting, and the Freedom Front Plus guy became the mayor. The ANC is the deputy mayor, and the lady from the Patriotic Alliance serves as the speaker. And the other parties in this government of local unity are all serving in the mayoral committee. So we are absolutely committed to make a huge success of this. We want to demonstrate this nonsense that only the DA can govern. We will show that's the opposite. But the invitation is still there for the Democratic Alliance to join that, because I honestly believe by them not being part of this, by staying out, they are not serving the interests of the 28% of the electorate in the greater Oudtshoorn that they represent. In that instance, they're now playing the opposition role, which puts them in exactly the same position as MK and the EFF on national level. You've got nothing to say.
For its part, the DA says the Freedom Front has been spoiling for a fight and is using its version of events as an excuse to push through this proposed divorce. Its spokesman on the topic is Oudtshoorn constituency head Dr. Mark Burke. He's a well-educated fellow, having attended Cambridge as a Rhodes Scholar and only recently moving into politics after a successful career in fintech. I asked him why the DA was apparently putting so much at stake by supporting its mayor, Chris McPherson.
The principle here is when the mayor starts doing his job, which will sometimes be hard, which will sometimes entail making tough decisions, that is exactly the point where you step in and say, I stand behind this gentleman. I won't start undermining him at this point. I drove into Oudtshoorn this morning, and on my left there's this massive development happening, which I think is part of, you know, the manufactured reasons presented to us of why the mayor has to go. But it is by far the biggest investment in Oudtshoorn's history. And there was a dispute over who should pay for a pipe that, you know, delivers sewage from the facility, on which the council took a leading a legal opinion from a leading law firm, which indicated that the council was liable for the cost. The developer then threatened from their side to also present a separate legal opinion stating the same thing. And given all of these factors, the decision was made to support this development. Now, I must point out that at no point in this whole process has Mr. McPherson been found guilty of any wrongdoing. There's merely this feeling that he was assertive in driving ahead with a needed process that separate independent experts were telling us is what needs to happen. We left to try and pick up the pieces and discern why this is happening. Looking at the facts, we're not able to determine that, and we then have to ask, why is this actually happening? What's the bigger game at play here?
So you're seeing a lot more in it, in other words, in what's happening in Otsu, and that this could occur elsewhere in the country, and a trusted partner and a trusted ally no longer being so.
Absolutely. I don't want to get semantically stuck, but I also wouldn't say that we're seeing a lot more in it. The Freedom Front Plus took great exception to my calling them a minority party, which of course is what they are in the Western Cape, where Dr. Mulder is the leader. They attained 1.4% of the vote in this last election, and we attained 55% of the vote, which does make us a majority party here. So I don't see a lot more in it than that. You know, the Freedom Front Plus is not able to disproportionately affect the course of the DA's willingness and ability to serve society. But I am seeing more into the manufactured outrage in Otsu than what's actually happened on the ground. And I'm led to believe that maybe there's another game at play, for which we would soberly suggest that you know, calmer heads prevail. let's not upset working municipalities.
We've spent time here because the implications of all this for South Africa's body politic are significant. Taken to its logical conclusion, the split between the DA and the Freedom Front threatens stability in 9 municipalities in the Western Cape alone. There are many others that will also be affected elsewhere by a full-blown divorce were it to occur, most notably the city of Tshwane, where the DA-led coalition has been in control since the November 2021 local election, but only thanks to support from, inter alia, the Freedom Front Plus. Well, our political insider, Neil De Beer, leader of the United Independent Movement, suggests that none of what we've just experienced is random, and something actually had to give. Here's the relevant part of what he told my colleague Chris Stain in their regular Sunday afternoon chat. And you can pick that up by going on to BizNews TV on YouTube. It's fascinating insights. Tens of thousands of people watch it as soon as it comes out every Sunday, because Neil is almost the ultimate insider. He's in the camp, and yet he provides everything that he knows, after a lot of research too, and tapping onto his own contacts, to the rest of us. Thanks, Neil.
Helen Ziller has a plan with the GNU, and the GNU clearly has no counter plan for Helen Ziller. So she's going to irritate the ANC. She's going to wreckball them every opportunity she has. Something's going to have to give. Because what you can clearly see is that the GNU is currently going ahead. There's now accusations that the poor ANC is now being outshined by the new ministers, the Gaetans, the Leon Schreibers, the John Steenhuisens, the McPhersons. Listen, hey, you don't sit back and say you're being outshined. Outshine yourself. Work to that effort. What we can clearly see is that new brooms are sweeping cleaner under Peter Grunewald and the rest. And here's the fact. Either the DA is going to dominate this and continually outwork, outshine, outmove, or the ANC is going to continually to outmaneuver, outplan, outbreak, outdemonize the continual efforts to bring this GNU to what we, the citizens of this country, are praying, hoping for, and that is a better life for all.
So remember to catch the full interviews featured in News Wrap clips on the BizNews TV channel on YouTube. Chris has been highlighting the actions of many courageous whistleblowers over the past few months, among them the indomitable lawyer Sarah Berger, whose exposure of a well-documented corruption at Fort Hare University led to a predictably vicious response from the crooks. Despite having been jailed and charged with criminality, shades of SAPS whistleblower Patricia Michelle Morgan, who also was featured on this program recently, Ms. Berger is unbowed.
There's character assassination in order to gag witnesses, which I believe is what has happened to us. There are people being shot at and assassinated and murdered because people are trying to cover up truths that are out there. Yes, we have instructed our attorney to notify the state that we will be suing them. The basis for that case is huge constitutional violations. I don't want to go into too many of them. I'll just say that, for instance, as an attorney myself, I was denied the opportunity to speak to an attorney whilst I laid in jail. Now, the retaliation that we've experienced, and which we believe is very politically motivated, is that we've uncovered something and we formed a view based on thousands and thousands of documents. And that view and the evidence that supports it is now turned as a smoking gun towards us, because we are effectively the wrongdoers now and we need to be silenced. And I can send a message out to the people that I investigated. I will not stop, and I will continue to support law enforcement. And where there is wrongdoing, you are going to have to pay the price. I did not decide your actions for you.
On to the big story that's happening at our neighbour right now. And it's been a couple of years already that we've been highlighting the energy-related developments in Namibia. But after a false start a few decades back, many there who should be enthusiastic about it have actually been holding back. Well, no more. Here are the highlights of an in-depth investigation into the Namibian discoveries of oil and gas by our partners at Bloomberg.
Global energy titans are desperate to capitalize on the discoveries, with French multinational Total Energies hoping to start development on the Venus oil field as early as this year. And they aren't the only ones excited.
We drilled one well in Namibia, so a well, you know, in our industry, we know that we need to appraise and to continue. It seems that the discovery might be giant.
Well, it's certainly a basin that has seen some early exploration success by others. We've got one large block off Namibia that we expect to put an exploration well down in late this year or early next year.
To give you a sense of our belief in Namibia, roughly a quarter of our deep water exploration spend in 2023 and 2024 will be directed to Namibia. So it is a theater that we fundamentally believe in.
Bloomberg's Paul Burkhardt has been watching the developments closely. How big of a deal could this be for the country if there were to be a massive discovery, as you sort of allude to?
There's been a search for oil offshore Namibia for a long time. I was there, I think, about 10 years ago when I first moved to the continent. And there were a number of explorers that were out there. But finally, in 2022, Shell and Total both made discoveries there. And they've seen rough estimates holding as much as 11 billion barrels. So the fuzzy math is, if you multiply that by today's oil price, it's roughly $1 trillion. There's another discovery that was made that could be 10 billion barrels. So again, you kind of have to note that none of this has been deemed commercial yet. The oil might be there, but you have to figure out how to get it out. To put it into context, Nigeria, that's been Africa's biggest producer, has proven reserves of about 37 billion barrels. Just to get to the numbers that we're talking about right now really gives you a sense of scale. OPEC is even courting the government and could double, triple GDP. So it's enormous. It could really change things there.
And so we've heard Total discuss the fact that they plan to start work on this as early as the end of 2024. How quickly are they moving on this? Because I imagine there's quite a process to actually get things going and actually see the benefits of this.
Yeah, there's Shell also has things planned. Total seems to be a little ahead in the schedule. And overall, there's really like it's kind of a gold rush that's going on. The Portuguese explorer Galp, they made the other discovery. Chevron's bought into some of the blocks. And the other big oil companies that don't have a foothold yet, they're going to be looking to buy into these areas offshore. So we've reported sources saying Exxon has interest in the Galp discovery. Just about every big oil company is looking in the Orange Basin where they've struck oil. Things are moving quite quickly. So when I was in Walvis Bay last, which is just on the coast, I could see oil equipment on the pier, people, workers with coveralls that are marked with like Schlumberger, one of the oil service companies, see those in town. And so it's happening. You hear officials talking about companies wanting land. And there's really activity brewing. It's really poised to start.
Well, as a local authority, we have received a lot of interest for people trying to acquire land for storage facilities. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we're also looking at. But it's very difficult, you know, when we can't continue operating the way we are operating.
And is it safe to call this the last big oil rush, Paul? Is that too dramatic of a term? I mean, I wonder sort of how you place this against what else we're seeing across the continent, as you were mentioning.
Yeah, I think from the look of things now, I would say yes. There are some other prospects in West Africa, North Africa. There's some significant discoveries in Ivory Coast where we've seen like really record developments. The Italian explorer Eni did like a really quick time, I think a couple of years between discovering the oil and producing it. They're going to do it as quickly as they can. And for as long as the international oil companies have the appetite to do it, this could be the last big development. Total CEO mentioned like 6 to 7 of these offshore vessels that can pump up to 180,000 barrels a day each that would put Namibia on the higher end of OPEC members from Africa. If it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen in Namibia.
Still on the continent, the expansion of Chinese companies into Africa is attracting increased attention. Our partners at The Economist devoted this week's cover story to the topic. Here's an excerpt from the leader that was written by The Economist's editors. You'll find it on BizNews Premium.
Since the end of the Cold War, the rich world's corporate giants have been the dominant force in global commerce. Today, consumers and workers in almost every country are touched in some way by the world-spanning operations of multinational firms from America, Europe, and to a lesser extent, Japan. These leviathans are now under threat as Chinese firms in industries from cars to clothing expand abroad with startling speed. A new commercial contest has begun. Its battleground is neither China nor the rich world, but the fast-growing economies of the global south. The precise shape of Chinese expansion is, however, a consequence of policies of governments in the West and China. As rich countries erect trade barriers to keep out Chinese goods, including solar panels and EVs, some Chinese firms are attempting to skirt restrictions by shifting production to the global south. At the same time, selling to emerging markets in their own right has become more attractive too. The company's path has been smoothed by the efforts of Chinese government to build diplomatic ties with the global south, notably by facilitating $1 trillion of infrastructure investment through the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI. Policymakers in host countries have an opportunity to enrich their own consumers, create jobs, and foster innovation and competition. But to do so, they'll need to steer between protectionism on one hand and passivity on the other. As in the West, local industries competing with Chinese companies will cite China's fondness for subsidies and seek special protection. Already, Brazil has introduced tariffs on EVs, and some Chinese exports are facing levies in Indonesia. Yet, to shut out Chinese products would deprive consumers of the benefits of choice and innovation, and shield unproductive and stagnant local industries from competition. but policymakers should also beware of being too lax. Some have already been burnt as BRI debts went sour. Much of the business being done by Chinese firms in the Global South today involves only final assembly. Many firms are reported to bring in Chinese workers rather than hire locally. For developing economies to truly benefit, they should press Chinese firms to employ more local workers, share technology, and heed local environmental and labour standards. China may well go along with this.
We end this episode of News Wrap on a sad note, marking the passing of a prominent member of the BizNews tribe. Earlier this week, well-known business leader and one-time South Africa's great tennis hope, Robbie Venter, passed away. He was 64. The former chief executive of Altron is survived by his wife, Sarah, who he met when on a tennis scholarship at a university in California, their daughters Caitlin and Kristen, and other family members including his brother Craig and his father Bill. As a teenager, Robbie Venter was poised to become a challenger for the top ranking in tennis in the world, having reached the semi-finals at Junior Wimbledon and defeating subsequent superstar Ivan Lendl and other contemporaries. But he never fully recovered from a freak injury to a wrist bone and joined his father Bill's creation, Altron, after just 7 years on the world tennis circuit. At Altron, Robbie progressed as a trainee through the managerial ranks until, after a decade and a half, he was appointed chief executive, a position that he held there for 16 years until 2017. Always impeccably dressed, mannered and behaved, Robbie Venter was a gentleman in the very best sense of the word. He was also a friend. Rest in peace, Robbie. You'll be greatly missed by all who had the privilege of knowing you. Until next week, I'm Alec Hogg of BizNews.com.